Hello and welcome to PLUS Magazine. Now, if you have studied physics at school, you will have come across some of the laws of nature. These rules, or laws, are usually phrased in mathematical form and they allow you to understand and predict how the things in the world around you behave. Newton's laws of motion, for example, tell you how an object of a certain mass is going to react when you apply a force to it. An interesting thing is that those laws are often relatively simple. Newton's second law can be expressed in a short equation that's quite easy to understand, even if you're a school student. And an interesting question is how this simplicity fits with the fact that the world around us, which is made up of the outcomes of the laws of nature, is incredibly complex, varied, and even chaotic. We put the question to John Barrow, a mathematician and cosmologist at the University of Cambridge. So, John, could you give us an idea of what the difference is between a law of nature and an outcome of a law of nature?
Well, at the simplest level, scientists in general and physicists in particular have been interested in what one might call the habits and the regularities of nature. If you look back to the earliest human histories, you find people seem to be more impressed by the irregularities of nature, earthquakes, disasters, and so forth. And they're the things that find their way into their historical records. But eventually people realise that if you've studied the regularities of nature, the fact that the seasons came round on a regular basis and the tides had a certain pattern, then you could exploit this for your benefit. And so began a human preoccupation with the regularities of nature. And also a feeling for, if you did something, what was the consequence? So the idea of a cause and an effect. If we go back to the time of Newton, we notice that scientists operated by carrying out experiments or observing things in the world, and then they would try to see patterns in what they saw, and then they would try to guess a rule or a law which governed those patterns. So it might be that all bodies acted upon by no forces remain at rest or move at constant speed. Or if you apply a force to a mass, then it will accelerate in a particular way. So there's emphasis upon the laws of events that you see. But gradually people realise that these laws of change were equivalent to some other types of statement that something else, more abstract, almost platonic, doesn't change. So a quantity like energy or electric charge or momentum, these are conserved quantities and don't change. And instead of saying that a particular law of cause and effect governed motion, you could say that there was a certain invariance, something that would never change about the world. So it might be that the laws of mechanics were the same in every direction. No matter how you orientate your laboratory, you'd always find the same laws. And this was equivalent to the conservation of angular momentum. Mm-hmm. And the fact that you should find the laws at any time you carried out the experiment is the same as the conservation of energy. So eventually, in the 20th century, physicists became so impressed by these invariances that followed from laws of change that they started thinking first about the invariances and using the mathematics of group theory, which catalogues all of them, to see what would be all the possible types of invariance that there could be. In the study of the fundamental forces of nature, physicists have found particular invariances and symmetries whose preservation can be responsible for the rules and the laws that govern each of the forces of nature. Now, each of these theories has a particular, rather abstract pattern that is preserved. And the preservation of that pattern is responsible not just for the rules governing how the forces behave, but also for dictating which particles can exist, so what the object of the laws actually is. So this is a very powerful situation. Now, the number of forces of nature at low energy is quite small. We believe it's 4. And as you go to higher and higher energies, we believe that they will all become united into a single force. So it's as though you've got 4 patterns at low energy, like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, and you want to join them together so that they become part of a much larger pattern. And you hope that the joining together of the pieces places some new constraints on what's in the individual pieces, which might be predicting new particles or new things that you can check.
So that's pretty fascinating, and it does work, because the famous example is the Higgs boson, isn't it?
Yeah.
That was predicted, 40 years before its discovery,
yes,
or more.
And the W and Z bosons are another example, long ago, where in order to join the force of electromagnetism, so to link that piece of a jigsaw to the weak interaction piece, it required that there be new elementary particles, the 2 W bosons and the Z0 boson, which mediate that coupling together of the two pieces. And they were found at CERN long ago. So that's a good example of how being able to join pieces together makes a prediction.
Mm-hmm.
One of the features of this, though, is that physicists have become so impressed by the power of the symmetries and of the laws that they can pick the symmetries first. It's as though you're picking the laws and then you work out the outcomes to test whether you've made the right choice. And the key point for our discussion here really is that the laws, the symmetries, you know, they have a Platonic perspective, they are possibly mathematically rather simple. But the outcomes can be fantastically complicated. And in some cases, like quantum chromodynamics or modern string theory...
Quantum chromodynamics describes the strong
interaction.
Yeah.
So you have mathematical arguments that lead you to have a candidate for the laws, but you don't know how to solve the laws to work out the outcomes.
Mm.
So the outcomes are much more complicated.
This leads us to the idea of symmetry breaking. The fact that a symmetry that is present in the laws of nature does not necessarily have to be visible in the outcomes of the laws of nature. We asked Barrow to explain further.
Suppose you have a law of gravitation, then the law of gravity is perfectly democratic with regard, say, to directions in the universe. So it doesn't say that if I balance a pencil on my hand that it always has to fall over in that direction, towards the pole star or something like that. But we know that if we were to balance a pencil in a perfect vacuum at zero temperature, as it were, quantum fluctuations will always make it fall in some direction. So when it falls, that symmetry with respect to direction is broken. So the outcome does not possess this democracy with respect to all directions. But the probability that it would fall in any direction would be the same for any direction.
Mm.
So you and I are located at particular positions in the universe at the moment. But the laws of electromagnetism and gravity, which are responsible for us at some basic level, don't have preferred positions in the universe. But we are examples of outcomes of the laws of nature where the symmetries of the laws are broken in the outcomes. And this is one of the secrets of the universe, if you like, how it can have all these complicated things in it. If the outcomes of the laws had to possess the same symmetries as the laws, then there wouldn't be anything in the universe.
Yeah.
It would be a rather boring place.
So can we think of the universe as something that, when it started right after the Big Bang, was essentially very symmetrical because it was a soup of very similar particles, so you could move it around, shift it, it would look the same, but that then sort of like crystallized, like the pencil falling off its tip. There is the underlying mathematical symmetry behind it, but the universe fell to one side and therefore came up with asymmetrical things. Would that be a way of thinking about
it? Yes, one way that physicists tend to view development of particle physics theories now is, as you go to higher and higher energies and temperatures, that will be like going back to the beginning of the universe in time, then more and more symmetries are restored. And similarly, as you came away from the singularity at the beginning, the temperature was falling. The expectation is at first, you know, everything is highly symmetrical, and then gradually certain thresholds are reached. You reach a particular temperature, and the strong force will become different to the others, so a symmetry will have broken. And eventually the weak force, electromagnetism, will become different forces. So as the universe cools, there are these symmetry-breaking moments, rather like the pencil falling in one direction. And certain aspects of the symmetry breaking at some moment may be random, okay, or, you know, it may be universal. So as the universe has cooled, things have become less and less in equilibrium, they're less and less symmetrical in some sense, and more complicated.
And if we heated the universe up again, would the symmetry be restored? Would the forces be unified again?
Yes.
So it's something that is reversible.
Yeah, so if you were to carry out at CERN, for example, experiments at ever-increasing energy, which is what they are doing, although they're not at energies anywhere near approaching the first moments of the Big Bang, actually. One of the aims to test this overall idea is to see if you can make these symmetries restore themselves. So the one that's being looked at currently is to see if you can reach an energy where supersymmetry, as it's called, between particles of different types of spin could be restored. And when that happens, you expect new types of particle to appear. So that's indeed what CERN and other accelerators are engaged upon. They're trying to reconstruct a world where the energy is much higher and certain symmetries are restored, which at the low energies today are absent or broken, as we say.
Symmetry breaking is one mechanism by which a complex world of outcomes can arise from a world of relatively simple and symmetrical laws of nature. But there is another mechanism by which complexity can arise from order. It's called chaos.
Well, we said we had this interesting dichotomy between the laws of nature, which are rather few in number, they're highly symmetrical, in some sense they're rather simple. But the outcomes of the laws are much more complicated. They're not necessarily symmetrical, and they're much harder to understand. And in the late 1970s, there was something of a revolution in many sciences, brought about by the development of the personal computer. So before then, there were computers, of course, but they were incredibly expensive, and they were the domain of large research groups doing blockbusting problems, like exploding stars, modelling the economy, or bombs, and trying to predict the weather, and so on. But personal computers allowed single individuals and small groups to do experimental mathematics for the first time, inexpensively and very simply, with very good interactive graphics. And so for the first time, you could start to study complicated phenomena which you couldn't analyze exactly with pencil and paper. So you can't solve these problems exactly, you know, in 30 minutes under examination conditions, and so they don't get studied in undergraduate programs. And so at the end of the 70s and in the 80s, you saw the beginning of the study of complexity, the study of chaos, complex self-organizing systems. They all grew around the availability of small computers. And so what was then being studied was the world of the outcomes of the laws of nature. And it was largely done by these experimental means, simulating what complicated systems would do, how they would organize themselves, and so forth. So this is the study of happenings, if you like, and it's quite different from the particle physics thread where you were studying the laws. So if someone comes along and asks me, you know, as they often have, is the world simple or is it complicated? I think the interesting answer is, if you look at the world at the level of the laws of nature, it's simple. and there might ultimately only be one fundamental law of nature. And if you're the sort of person that spends their working day trying to understand the laws of nature and join them together, you will tend to think that the universe is simple, because you look at it in this Platonic way at the level of the laws. But if you're a sort of squalid state physicist or a biologist or an economist, a meteorologist, you study the complicated world of the outcomes, and actually you never talk about laws of nature. No biologist would ever talk about laws of physics or laws of nature. They're just trying to find little bylaws and patterns within parts of this complicated world of the happenings. And so for you, the world is certainly not simple. What we see is the end state, the long-term stable outcome of all sorts of competing effects. And the stable outcome might be the result of natural selection. It might be the result of another type of stability in the long run. So for those people, the world is complicated. And you begin to see how the world is actually both simple and complicated, depending on whether you focus on the laws of nature, the symmetries behind the appearances, or on the outcomes and the happenings, which is another perspective of science.
Mm. So basically we can think of the world as simultaneously complex and simple in a way that doesn't contradict each other.
So the two are complementary perspectives. One of the developments in science over the last 20 years that small computers have sort of promoted is the much more detailed study of all the weird things that are going on in that world of the complicated happenings. I mean, the basic idea that there are certain processes which are extremely sensitive to ignorance is what chaos is. So if you have a little bit of uncertainty in the location of some of the molecules in this room, then after a few seconds, if you followed the trajectories of those molecules, you would have massive uncertainty in where they're located. And the weather's like this. So it's not that we don't understand the weather and all the bits of physics that go into it. We do, and we have very good equations to actually predict how the weather will change. But we don't know the state of the weather now in every position with perfect accuracy. We might have weather stations every 50 or 100 miles or something like that. But the scope for little variations in between is great enough so that when you run your computer simulation, if you interpolate a little bit differently between the weather stations, you could end up getting a very different forecast for tomorrow and certainly for next week. So this is chaos. It's just the rapid growth of small uncertainties. So it's a very simple idea.
And this supposedly simple idea of chaos is what we're going to leave you with today. To find out more about this and many other topics, visit PLUS Magazine at plus.maths.org. Thanks for listening, and bye-bye.